I think we're going to get started. Not to break up conversations here, but I'm Ed McCord. I'm the director of the Senior Center for Asian Studies. We're very pleased today to have part of our visiting scholar roundtable, one of our visiting scholars, Professor Shoko Yamada, who comes to us as a Fulbright scholar from Nagoya University. She's an associate professor of the long title, International Development and Education Policy Studies. Is that right?
Yeah.
And her topic today is very related then to her field, which is on international aid, particularly educational international aid, and donors. So without further ado, I'm just going to turn the talk over to you.
Thank you very much for a kind introduction. This is very end of my short stay in the U.S. as a visiting scholar. I'm leaving next week. And I had such a wonderful time here, and I really appreciate the opportunity provided by Segal Center and staff members here. The title of my presentation today is Emergence of New Donors and Paradigm Shift in International Education Development. And as Ed has kindly introduced, my field of specialization is education and development. But I think you are more interested in the more broader picture of international development. So I try to give you an overview of the international development and paradigm shift in a bigger picture than specifically focusing on education, but rather using education as a case study. And the countries I have been looking at are US, Japan, South Korea, and China. And it's not only my personal project as individual, it is a research project as a team of scholars. And I have partners in South Korea, China, and the US, of course, in George Washington University. And also I'm working closely with some other scholars in Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei. And assuming that you are not very working closely with the international development field, I just give you some background. This field of international development or cooperation, development cooperation, is changing dramatically in the last few years. One of the major factors of change is the change of actors. The traditional donors, like Western donors, European and North American actors, and some non-European actors like Japan, has been going through the stagnation of economy, and they have reduced the total amount of ODA year by year since the middle of the 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s. And at the same time, there are new actors emerging, state actors are emerging, who used to be the recipients of aid, but now turning to be the providers of aid. And today's presentation focuses on these actors' diversification. But there are also other factors which are causing the shift of paradigm. One is a normative change. The norms which most of the development actors has been sharing and following is going to change. That I'm going to explain quickly, and the actors which I'm going to explain the focus of this presentation, and modalities of aid, the methods of providing aid. And there are many forums to set the norms and building consensus, which is also going through some changes. So this is to show you how the state actors are changing, the composition of state actors are changing. The DAC donors, DAC means, I think you know, the OECD's Development Assistance Committee. So the members of DAC are the countries who are providing development assistance, and it's, I think, 28 countries are now members, and most of them are in Europe. And US, Canada, and Japan has been the long-lasting members since the 1960s. And Korea, South Korea joined it in 2010, recently. So South Korea is the second non-Western donor in the DAC community. And still, nearly 70% of the bilateral ODA. Bilateral in this case means that aid provided directly to the assisted countries, not through the multilateral channels such as United Nations or the World Bank. You know, the countries like US or Japan contribute funds to the World Bank or the United Nations, and then these international organizations provide aid on behalf of the member countries. That is multilateral aid. But bilateral aid is directly provided to the assisted countries. And these are the total amount provided in the bilateral channel. And still 70% of the bilateral aid is provided by DAC members. But this proportion has shrinked drastically in the last few years. And the 30% is now provided by non-DAC members. And China is growing dramatically, which I think most of you know. India, Brazil, Russia, South Africa, the BRICS countries, and also other EU members than the DAC members, and Chinese Taipei, Thailand, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and some other countries. So that is a landscape now. And I also would like to point out that there are also other actors which are increasing their presence, that is civil society organizations. In the international development scenes, we tended to look only at the state actors, former state actors and multilateral organizations. But now the growing influence comes from the global network of civil society organizations. And the characteristic of such a network of civil society organizations is that they are not vertically organized as the state government. It is horizontal network across the national border, and it is mission-driven. So the state government will provide official development aid based on their national agendas and the national the resources. But this civil society network is more mission-driven, and the nose of the network is composed of experts and professionals. So it is a completely different nature of the actors, and but at the same time they influence at the global level and national level the agenda setting of the international development. Now I'll quickly overview what the aid structure. I would say that the 1990s and the first decade of the 2000s are the period of great deal of harmonization and unification. The international development actors accumulated some experience of providing aid after the World War II, and they started to think at the end of the 1980s that providing aid in separately among the different actors would not be productive enough, efficient enough. For example, the USAID may provide some assistance for teacher training in English, for example, and another donor may come in and revise the textbooks for French language, or still other donor may come in to build the school buildings, and they don't communicate with each other. That would not be a very efficient way of providing aid. So at the beginning of the 1990s, the donor community started to, align more tightly with each other and try to control each other along the same line of methodology of providing aid, and also sharing the same goal to achieve. And in terms of the methods of providing aid, there are five principles agreed. Paris Declaration in 2005 was agreed among about the 150 national governments, including both the aid providing and recipient countries and major donor organizations. And the five principles include the ownership, fostering ownership of the assisted country government, and the alignment with the national policy of the assisted country instead of picking specific paths, trying to contribute to the national goal. and harmonizing among the donors. And the ideal form of assistance was said to be budget support. Instead of doing separate projects, you should agree on the policy at the macro level, and then you provide budget for implementing that policy. So the implementation is largely in the hands of assisted country governments, not in the hands of aid-providing country. So that was the idea in the 1990s and 2000s. But now it is changing, partly largely because of the emergence of new actors. So this conference on aid effectiveness has been held regularly. And the one on 2011 was hosted by South Korean government, Busan High Level Forum. And it was just the next year after Korea has joined the OECD DAC. So you can see how much Korea is kind of aggressively trying to take the lead now. And then this Busan High Level Forum added new aspects or new modalities of aid to this standard five principles in the Paris Declaration. One is South-South or the triangular cooperation. I'm not sure how much you are familiar with that kind of term, but South-South cooperation means that the cooperation between the developing countries and developing countries instead of vertical North-South cooperation. And triangular cooperation means that the fund or technical assistance would come to the middle country, like middle-level income country, and then that mid-level income country will provide training for lower developing country government officials. So it is a two-level cascading kind of model of providing aid. And so these new kind of ideas about development cooperation started to emerge. So that is the aspect of methodologies of aid, which is changing. And this is a norm. One of the reasons why I'm doing this research now in 2013, we started in 2012, is the major goals agreed in the international development fields aim at 2015. And we have been discussing about what to do next after 2015. So nowadays, the discourse about post-2015 is getting really, really heightened. So seeing what will happen before and after 2015 will be really interesting to highlight the nature of paradigm shift. And I don't want to go into details, but those eight goals on the right side, Millennium Development Goals, are the set of goals agreed again among all the international actors. It was agreed on 2000, and the target year is 2015. And this is a bigger overarching goal for social and economic development. And absolute goal is achieving eradication of poverty. And to eradicate the poverty, there are more specific goals, like education, health, and environment, and stuff like that. And regarding my field of specialization, education, universal primary education has been incorporated to this broader framework of Millennium Development Goal. So the left side, EFA, stands for Education for All Goals. So the left side goals, six goals, are the overarching goal in the field of education. So they have more wider coverage of educational issues, from early childhood to vocational education or adult literacy education. But when the Millennium Development Goal was agreed among the international actors, this universal free compulsory education, basically universal primary education, and gender equity was incorporated into the bigger picture. So practically, these two are the goals in the education sector until the 2015. That is the situation. And just in case you don't know, you are not familiar with the education terms, universal free education means that basically education is considered to be a human right. Everybody is supposed to be in the school. And so universal means that 100% enrollment rate at the primary school level across the world. That is a goal. Then again, this normative framework is getting less tightening these days. One of the factors is that because of the focused resources onto simply the universal primary education goal, that goal is close to be achieved. So across the world, even in the small villages in Africa, nowadays many children go to school. And this goal is rather easier compared to other educational goals to be agreed and to be targeted at, because you can quantify the results in this case, because you can count the number of children in the school, you can count how many schools has to be constructed additionally to accommodate children, you can count how many teachers are still lacking. So it is rather easier to set the target in terms of universal basic education or universal primary education. But now, as we see that this target is close to be achieved, then it is like opening up the Pandora's box. No, the next step is more complicated. So, for example, when you talk of the improvement of learning, then what do you mean by learning? Do you mean by exam scores, or do you mean by the children's capacity to apply the knowledge to their daily life, or is it the experience in school? So the next step is more diverse and less agreed upon. And this is not only in the education sector. Widely in this Millennium Development Goal in general, it used to be easier by 2015, but after 2015, it will be more complicated step to follow, and it is more difficult to get the consensus and concentrate the resources. I'm running short of time, so I just this to illustrate how much the resources used to be concentrated on primary education in 2004. Yellow part is primary education. So, and then rapidly the resources shifting to other education field. So the yellow part has shrinked in just 4 years, from 2004 to 2008. So to just summarize, until the recently, the aid is more, the donors, actors are more clearly visible, and they agreed among themselves to control each other, and they share the process, and they share the target. That was a period of harmonization, which started from the beginning of 1990s. But now the post-2015 period will be more scattered. The process, the path to get to the results will be diverse. The goal itself is so ambiguously shared, and actors have different intentions. That is the situation. And the emergence of new actors are one of the key factors which is causing this phenomena. Then, and now I'm going to shift to the case studies of four state actors. I don't think I have too much time to explain each of them, but roughly let me classify them into three groups. One is traditional OECD DAC donors. Among the four, US and Japan are this category. but these two were not the typical OECD DAC donor either. Both US and Japan could not adopt the methodologies of budget support because of their domestic restriction. They have to prove their performance by demonstrating results directly linked to the investment. So they have to stick to the project type assistance. So in that sense, both U.S. and Japan could not move too far to align with the OECD DAC mainstream. So that is the difference of U.S. and Japan from European and multilateral donors. And then Korea is the second group. It's non-traditional, but it joined OECD DAC pretty recently. So it has a will to align with the traditional way of doing things. At the same time, they want to demonstrate their uniqueness and newness. And the third group is non-traditional and non-OECD DAC donor, which is, in this case, China. So let me start with my country, Japan, which I know best. This case, Japan's case, shows the ambivalence between search for uniqueness and willingness to align with the DAC community. Japan became the top bilateral donor in 1989 for the first time. And then since then, until the middle of the 2000s, the first decades of 2000, Japan was one of the two major bilateral donors together with the US. Now it is seventh, so it dropped sharply in the last few years. So when it emerged as one of the top donors, it developed the ODA Charter. And it tried to establish a various system for example, training the professionals for international development, policy framework, and new types of program implementations and decision-making mechanism. All kinds of things were reformed in this early 1990s. And actually, the graduate school I'm teaching now, GSID, Graduate School of International Development in Nagoya University, was established in 1993 for the purpose of training the professionals who can design, implement, and negotiate with other major donors and government recipient government in the field of international development. So we have only the graduate school, and we train the Japanese national and students from developing countries on Japanese government scholarship to acquire the advanced degree. So during this period, Japan has established the system very much. And then the ODA Charter has major three characteristics which I'd like to highlight today. One is a clear effort to align with the ODA DAC new development strategy. So as a member of the DAC, OECD DAC, it tried to clearly demonstrate how Japanese ODA follow the overall DAC strategy. And at the same time, it is one of the key philosophy of Japanese ODA, which is also echoed in many Asian donors which followed Japan, is the support for self-help effort. The idea was this. Japan started its post-World War development from the ash. It was defeated, we didn't have anything, but we achieved development very quickly, and then we now provide aid. But we are not providing aid as a donor who is standing high up and trying to pull you up to my status. No, I'm not that paternalistic or authoritarian type of donor. That is the Japanese attitude. No, we used to be like you. And we stand side by side with you. We run together with you. So please tell us what you need. We are willing to provide that. That is the basic philosophy of Japanese ODA. And then it highlights the importance of investment in human resources and education. No, one of the explanation of the Japanese quick recovery from the World War II was that we have basis of good human resources in the society. We have the tradition of investing in people. So that's why even though we lose many physical resources, we have human resources. That's why we could recover very quickly. So our strategy is to invest in people. So education has been always in the core of Japanese aid philosophy. Not called as education, like going to school, but investing in people, training people. That is part of Japanese ODA. So the idea was that the overall thing is that Japan always tried to be good as the dark donor. It is very proud of being the top ODA provider, you know, and it is very proud to be the sole Asia member of DAC, so it has to be very good. But at the same time, it wanted to be unique. And sometimes being unique and being good, according to the expectation of European community, is not so easy. You know, if you try to be unique too much, you may be seen like today's China, you know, you are not behaving nicely, you are not following the rule. So, and in the case of Japan, Japan didn't like to be called like that. It wanted to be good. So that ambivalence always, you know, existed behind the, you know, not so decisive way of doing things in Japanese ODA. And the US. Sorry to run. I don't have time. The U.S. is a traditional outlier, as I said, and I don't want to spend too much time on USA because you must know better than me. But the nature of U.S. ODA is very politicized because of the very strong Congress control and also the strong civil society influence. Just one thing I'd like to highlight is the linkage of that issues prioritized in the international development aid projects with the domestic concern. That is not seen in Japan or Asian actors. In Asia, ODA is ODA, completely separate field. So those specialists of ODA, either in the field of education or health or economics, they are working in that field. They don't, you know, get influenced by the domestic concerns. But in the case of US, the agenda setting is completely identical to what people discuss domestically. For example, AIDS issues are highlighted in health sector or in the education sector nowadays. USAID is shifting a lot of efforts to early grade learning. Early grade learning means that head start, the good quality of education at the lower grade of primary school. That I think is domestic concern too. So it is echoed pretty identically in the international development projects too. That is clear difference from Asian donors. And other things I will just skip. And I'll skip. And Korea. It's trying to pass Japan on the same way, on the same route. So it's following, but it's trying to pass Japan. It joined DAC, as I said, in 2010, and it's wearing realigning with the DAC framework, but trying to be unique, as Japan has done. And the ODA implementation structure is modeled after Japan. So they have an organization called KOICA, Korean International Cooperation Agency, whose organization structure, if you look at the organization chart, you can see how they are identical to the JICA's case, Japan International Cooperation Agency, and aspiring to be a leading donor. It will host 2015 World Education Conference. Now, I have already said that Korea has hosted the 2011 Aid Effectiveness Conference. Now it has also committed to host the 2015 World Education Conference. As I have said, 2015 is a very crucial year. And the conference, which will be held on this year, will declare the common agenda, which will rule the whole field well, the magnitude should have influence maybe less than area period, but still it is very significant conference to be held in 2015, and Korea has already committed. So, but you know, I think the Korean way of motivating and doing things is that you stand the flag first, you commit to have something, and then the substance will follow. So I think now they are making very strenuous effort to do research and design programs and train people. It's really a dramatic process. Everything is moving very fast in South Korea now. And also selling Korean model of development. I have attended one conference in regarding the African education development, which was participated by the delegates from many countries, and Korea hosted one whole day event, Korea Africa Day. and then what they did was to present how Korea was achieved this success in 50 years. No, what they said to African delegate was that 50 years ago, we were poorer than you. No, we experienced the Korean War. When we were kid, we didn't have much clothes to wear, much food to eat. You know, look at this picture. We were so poor. Then, but in 50 years now, we achieved this. And we can share our experience with you. So that is, you know, kind of similar argument Japan has made in the 1980s and 90s, but in a more strategic manner and very straightforward. So, and also it echoed the same kind of the philosophy of investing in human resources. Why could we achieve this rapid economic development in 50 years? Because we have the basis of human resources. That is the same argument. Now, China. It is an emerging global power, and it has a philosophy of solidarity. So Chinese ODA comes from a completely different place. It has a history of solidarity aid since the 1950s. So in many former communist countries in Africa, China has been one of the few sources of external aid when the Western donors did not approach them. You know, during the Cold War period, the Western bloc and communist bloc were competing to win the supporters. And Africa and in Latin America, they were competing to get the countries to be in their side. And the communist countries received aid from Soviet Union and China. So they have long history of receiving assistance, which is more for solidarity, according to what they call it, than to aid. So the financial and technical assistance for developing countries are considered not as aid, not the vertical kind of aid, but as cooperation, a mutually beneficial relationship. And so Japanese aid philosophy of self-help effort is more directly succeeded by China than by Korea. Or I wouldn't say everything comes from Japan. I think the Korean has its own route of claiming that their aid is for self-help, not for, you know, pulling people up to our stage. And about the difficulty of knowing what China is doing is that information is not collected or conceptualized according to the framework of so-called ODA. Now, I think those actors who came to put themselves into the Western ODA framework, they somehow reorganized themselves and tried to present themselves to fit to that framework. Japan has gone through that process in the 1980s. It has been very critically, very much criticized for not, you know, providing aid in the respectful manner. So they tried to fit to the expectations of the Western donor community. But China haven't done that and is not planning to do that kind of transformation. So if you want to understand what China is doing, you have to see how they conceptualize it and how the organization is structured instead of imposing the ODA framework. So that's why it is very difficult to understand what China is doing. The data on foreign aid is not collected according to the OECD DAC classification. So it's difficult for outsiders to understand what China wants to do and what they actually do. And another difficulty is that decision making and implementation are not concentrated under one governmental unit because it is not conceptualized as ODA as one practice. It is done by different line ministries and different agencies. So even for the Chinese officials, it is not easy to capture the overall picture of Chinese ODA. For example, in the field of human resource development and education, as many of you must know, the China has Confucius Institution, the Chinese language teaching institution. One of them is just established in GW. This year. So they have Confucius Institution everywhere. And that is organized, administered by the separate agency. And they also have many scholarship programs for the developing country government people to get the graduate level or undergraduate degree in China. And that is also administered separately. And they also have university partnering programs. So there are, I think, 10. I don't think they have increased the number. They have 10 universities in China which are chosen for that partner program. And then they are assigned to develop a partner program with the specific universities in Africa on the specific programs. So these partner programs, if you want to know about these programs, you have to go to these specific universities. And then they have also the human resource development training programs, which touch on any kinds of field, you know, the transportation, fishery, agriculture, government officials training, capacity building, teacher education, you know, all kinds of things are done by the line ministries. So Ministry of Health, Ministry of Transportation, Ministry of Education, they have their own training programs to be provided for the developing country officials. So as such, it is very difficult to get the overall picture. So just to wrap up, actually I don't think I can wrap up very nicely because it is still in the process of research and to summarize, the paradigm shift is caused by several factors. One is that it is difficult to say there is any single dominant model to align with anymore. No, in terms of norms, in terms of methodologies, and in terms of actors, in any sense, the identity of donor community is destabilizing. And the relationship between the donors and recipients are getting more multidimensional compared to what used to be more vertical and unified. And then we are trying to do with this project is to see the regionality of Asia Pacific. It's still in the process, but as I said, there are certain Asian features in the framing of development assistance, like the centrality of human resource development or the idea of self-help. That kind of things, I think, will be the basis of understanding the Asian regionality. Of course, there are rivalry among the Asian donors. It's not. It's kind of intimidating for Japan, for example, to have Korea, which is rapidly increasing the presence and following the same path, or China, which eating up the popularity of Japan in Africa or whatever. But at the same time, with these actors see the complementarity and similarity among themselves. So it's strange, interesting mutual relationship. And I think one of the academic possibility of doing this kind of research is to theorize a new landscape and power relationship. Well, since we are not a specialist of international relations, we have been using the framework of multilateralism so easily. We always say that this is, if we apply the international relation theory, this situation is multilateralism, you know, that all these state actors align together for the common goods, something like that. But now the situation is more network-oriented and more multipolar kind of situation, and I'm hoping to learn a great deal from the international relation theories and the most recent research in that field to explain what is happening in the international department. Thank you very much.
It's a wonderful presentation, actually, very nicely presented, too. I learned a lot. I think I have very narrow kind of American ideas of how the aid community works, and I really appreciate having some sense of how Asia also participates in the donor community. It's very interesting. I'm going to open this up to questions, then. I'll start here.
Great presentation, and I'm sorry I came in late, but I think I got the overall gist of it. The impression that I get is that despite the rivalry among the Northeast Asian countries, as you have on there, there's kind of an affinity and a kind of convergence. And I guess I wanted to press you a little bit more about how Japan, Korea, and China are similar in the sense that they're different from the Western donor countries. And you use the United States as a comparative angle, but the problem with the United States is that, as you say, the United States is unique. And so, in a sense, how do the three Northeast Asian countries kind of compare with the European donor countries? And it seems that you've got kind of two indicators. One is the emphasis on human resource development, and the other one is in terms of self-help. And so what I'd like to know is, on that metric, are you implying then that the European states don't emphasize self-help and don't emphasize relatively human resource development? Now, I raise that because there was the stereotypical view of Japan that in the earlier days, it wasn't emphasis on human resource development. It was the emphasis on infrastructure. And there was a lot of criticism of Japanese ODA because it was to develop the infrastructure for development, and it served the interests of Japanese companies. Now, in the face of that criticism, and also because the recipient countries were graduating from the status of infrastructure development, I think the amount of money that was spent on infrastructure declined, and that for human resource development. So what I'd like to know is whether China and Korea jumped that step. In other words, they're not doing infrastructure development, but they went straight to human resource development. And it would be good to have some kind of statistics about the amount of money spent on infrastructure versus human resource. The other is in terms of self-help. And how do you measure this emphasis on self-help? And you indicated that projects get generated by the recipient country, and then the donor provides the money. How do the European states compare to that? Oftentimes, again, this is a stereotypical view of Japan, but that Japanese aid tended to be much more in terms of loans rather than in grants. And that's what was the self-help, is that you got to be able to pay the money back. And Japan was criticized for that, but then the Japanese said, well, that's what makes these aid programs more effective. So I'd like to know whether Korea and China is also following that model, and whether that really differs from the European states.
Thank you very much. Shall I?
Yeah, a lot.
Sorry.
Thank you very much, Professor Mochizuki, for very insightful comments. The Northeast Asian countries' similarities. Okay. I think similar terms which European donors have used to the self-help is ownership. You know, ownership is the idea that we foster the developing countries' self-decision, and we trust them to do things. So the ownership of the process and decision making is theirs, not ours. That is, so the Japanese aid policy documents and the discussions often use these two terms, self-help effort and ownership, in a kind of interchangeable manner. I think it is one of the tacit, unconscious strategy of Japanese officials to somehow convert Japanese traditional way of thinking about self-help to the, you know, the dominant way of thinking about ownership. So, but the difference, while I'm still not quite well in explaining it with the evidence, but the self-help effort originally meant that the donor, Japan as donor, would not provide any prescription. So we will wait for you to come and say that what you need. But because of the exposure to the donor discourse, that kind of original philosophy changed its implementation. Now Japan would not wait for the request to come. Request is created by the the contractors or in the process of negotiation. So it takes the form of request in terms of documentation. But already it is just a matter of documentation, because Japan has to align with the global discourse. It has to contribute to the universal primary education and stuff. So these ideas are somehow adjusted and modified. And Korea, I think, is somehow similar. So it's more difficult to see this original form of self-help effort in Japanese or Korean aid. But in the case of China, I think it's more straightforward. And I don't know if I answered that question. And the human resource development, Asian conception of human resource development sometimes tend to be misunderstood as economic aid or industrial aid, because it is not contained in the field of education. For example, Japan construct infrastructure. It started to do a lot of infrastructure building, but it didn't end with that. It always came with the training of people who use that infrastructure, and that was part of the infrastructure aid, but it wasn't reported as such. So the donor, when the donor look at the record, it is only the infrastructure aid. But the human resource development has always been there in the form of economic aid. And so when you talk of the uniqueness or the difference between Western donors and East Asian donors, I think you have to go to the original conceptions of what it means to develop and how they frame that idea to the practices. Then sometimes you apply the framework which doesn't fit to what East Asians are talking about. And the human resource development is one of the typical fields as such, that it's not necessarily education, but it's always there. And according to one of the reports I have read about 10 years ago, which was the JICA's report to see how many of JICA's projects had a human resource development component, and actually 80% of them had, even in the 1960s and 80s. So that is the one of the answers to your question. I'm sorry, I'm so scattered, and I don't think I really answered your questions. Loans and grants. Yeah, I tried to think about it.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't want to hog the Q&A, but so it's very interesting when you're talking about kind of global norms and things. You talk about discourse and then how the Japanese had to kind of revise their practices to fit the global discourse to be accepted. So it wouldn't be such an outlier. But they kind of preserve some of the essence of their original conception.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you have two other countries that are coming in to this, and they also have very similar kind of approaches as Japan. So now, now that you've got three, although they're rivals, they may be much more convergent relative to the rest of the world in the donor community. So does that change the terms of the discourse? So that there's kind of a pushback, or is the rivalry among Japan, Korea, and China so intense that they, in a sense, don't work together to kind of push back against the dominant Western norm of assistance? I mean, from an international relations kind of theory point of view, mm-hmm. about norm creation and change, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very interesting question.
There are not much clear efforts to share ideas among these Asian actors. Now, Korea and Japan seems to work more closely. I often have some, you know, discussions and collaboration with Korean scholars, but Chinese scholars haven't really come into the scene, and also in terms of practice implementation, the Korean COICA and JICA works closely, but China do not come into the scene very often because they don't feel necessity to standardize or negotiate. Well, they are not the DAC members anyway. So, but then at the same time, I think the. So I don't know, it's starting, but there is no clear efforts to influence the dominant discourse.
Can I offer my comment?
Yeah, then I'll go back. Yeah, okay. Go ahead. You good? Go ahead.
Is it related?
Bad jump before.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that. Here comes a Chinese scholar.
Oh.
I'm not really a scholar. I'm a PhD candidate. My dissertation about Chinese foreign aid. Actually, my first proposal, my first draft of my dissertation is to try to compare American style of doing foreign aid and Chinese style of doing foreign aid and see if they're gonna like compete to like race to the bottom, or they're gonna compete each other. The funny thing is, they just do not care about each other. They basically go totally like compare ways, like go all the way. There's no way they cross over each other. So which I have to, you know, end my first proposal of my end my draft for my dissertation change to just to focus on Chinese foreign aid. And about what the gentleman just said about similarity between the East, Northeast Asia donors, the similarity. I want to say Japan is our, I'm just going to say for Chinese, not for Korea. I know nothing about Korean foreign aid programs, but for Chinese, Japanese foreign aid programs is our master chief. Totally. Master Shifu. Like from the panda, basically, first of all, yes, we, the similarity came from the almost the same idea of what is development and what is aid. Basically, Chinese and Japanese, we agree that aid cannot boost up from the poverty. You're gonna do most of the part by yourself. You can use aid as some kind of help, but you're gonna do most of the job by yourself. So Japanese way and Chinese way is to find a way to connect aid with business. So aid comes there first, and then investment and all kinds of other economic engagement come next. And with aid to like build up the connection between governments, between communities, between companies, all the investment can go there, large scale investment goes there. And no matter how the programs go, aid programs can go next. But the investment, FDI, is going to stay there. They're going to create jobs, they're going to create the revenues. They are the real essence of development. That is our way of thinking about that. The second part is more practical. The Chinese, we basically adopted the Japanese way of the like the bidding and the pending system of all the aid programs. We use the same as the request-based system. Basically, our companies go to the recipient country. They look for their project and they report to China and China or Japan government, ask for financial support, and the government support them with the finance, and then they do the jobs. So I just want to say this is similar.
We actually usually stop at an hour, but I want to run an extra 15 minutes if we can. If people need to go, you can go. Otherwise, we'll keep going for a little bit more. Deepa, do you want, and then
yes,
Linda.
I really enjoyed your presentation. I also wanted to do two questions, but one related to the self-help notion. And one aspect of looking at how much of that metric is included in the aid giving, I would think, is the modality. That is, the USA, you know, one looks at that and often, I haven't looked in a long time, but see that more than 90% is tied aid. That is, the aid comes back to the US. That is, you have to use certain type of contractors, you have to use buy American equipment and all that, not necessarily the cheapest. Everything is tied. That doesn't really give a lot of assistance in the self-help mode to those countries. So that's one difference, I would think. So my question is, in Japan, and maybe in Korea, what kind of conditions are attached to the aid? Okay? That's one.
Contract, right? The conditions for the contract.
Conditions for giving, if it's project finance, then are there these conditions that it has to be Japanese companies, it has to be from Japan, and so forth? Mm-hmm. Or is it just that they're allowed to buy from the cheapest or develop their own, domestic companies?
Yeah.
The second question is related to aid as soft power. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that Japan in the 80s and so forth, they didn't have a lot of foreign, assertive foreign policy and not many mechanisms for gaining influence in other countries. So I would think that foreign aid is a soft power, very uniquely associated with the countries like Japan, Germany, and so forth. If it is used strategically for political influence, I would think that it goes to certain countries and over others. And so, for example, in the case of India, it gives a lot of foreign aid, but a lot goes to Afghanistan. If you really do the analysis, so much goes to Afghanistan and Bangladesh, two countries, especially Afghanistan, they want to have influence, right? So is there some pattern like that in Japan and maybe Korea?
Okay. Thank you, Deepa, for very good questions. First question about self-help and tied aid. Actually, this tied aid discussion is also experienced a big shift nowadays. The U.S. is now trying to reduce the contractor-based projects because of some controversies of the contract with the domestic contractors, and now they are trying to reduce the amount of contract-based assistance. And ironically, they are the ones who are now shifting to budget support compared to Western European donors, which used to be the promoters of budget support, but getting tired of it. So it's, you know, interesting twist. And going back to the Japanese case, yes, this tied aid issue has been the symbolic issue for Japan not being aligning with the dominant way of doing things in the 1980s and 90s. So Japan has been very harshly criticized for tying the aid to flow back to Japan. So, and then Japan, as I said, is always trying to please Western community. So it has gone through a lot of reform to reduce the tied percentage of the tied aid. So there are different schemes of assistance. Loan has several different kinds, and the grant aid, and the technical cooperation projects. And loan is, or construction is, loan is first provided, the money is provided to the recipient country, and then the recipient country run the bidding. Solicit the proposal from the companies, and it nowadays it doesn't restrict it to Japan. But what is happening is that because of the single year budgeting system in Japan, the contractor has to be very, very efficient. You have to finish everything in 1 year. And it is so difficult for the local contractors to do that kind of things. So after all, oftentimes it's won by the Japanese companies. But nowadays you don't have the conditions that you have to hire Japanese companies. And what did I try to say?
The political influence, whether there was any, the aid as a soft power.
Oh, right, right. That's also another interesting thing. Because of the effort to be more purely humanitarian during the 1990s, Japan tried not to link ODA with the diplomatic agenda. No. So it tried to be purely contributing to the development agenda of poverty reduction. But now, because of the tightening budget, the government has to demonstrate how much beneficial this ODA money is for Japanese taxpayers. So, and also the emergence of some new actors also influenced that decision-making process either. That it's now, while in the 1980s and 90s, it was only Japan who seems not to follow the rules. But now there are many Asian actors who do many different kinds of things, and it's not only Japan who are responsible to follow the rule. So the Ministry of Foreign Affairs now make it clear that the aid has to serve the national interest. It's very big shift. And while I was involved in one of the program evaluation team in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and it was 2 years ago, and they adopt DAC OECD evaluation framework plus national interest, contribution to national interest. So it's a big shift. And I think that for Japan, I think one of our colleagues said, national interest is very closely linked with economic interest. So it is difficult to distinguish the private sector motivation and the governmental motivations, and then it is also closely linked with the issue of tied aid. So when we talk of the national interest and soft power, I think we also need to have some different frame of reference when you look at the agent donors.
Linda?
Yeah, thank you. Fantastic talk. I was interested in the way you characterized, you spoke about how Korea once went to Africa and said, this is our development model of human resource investment. But really that sets aside a lot of information about the development of the Korean economy and the conjuncture, and also for the Japanese economy, in which Japan's industry got a kickstart from U.S. military procurement for the Korean War.
Yeah.
And likewise, Korea got a kickstart of investment with its U.S. military procurement for the Vietnam War. So that's not happening in Africa.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, definitely, as you say, there is always, you know, a lot of emphasis on education in both Japan and in all the Northeast Asia countries, but it really sets aside a whole lot about development, you know, and Japan,
right.
Both Korea's and Japan's development and export orientation and so forth.
Yeah, so thank you very much. For
I don't know how they bring that into their discourse.
I think how people present their model and how people discuss about the issues is not necessarily supported by how things actually work.
No.
they want to present simple and easy to absorb kind of ideas. So in that sense, Korea is very good in strategically presenting impressive picture. And of course, I agree that these conditions which boosted the economic development in Japan and Korea doesn't exist in many African countries. And they are more resource-dependent countries, which is very different from the technology-dependent countries like Korea and Japan. But that kind of details are not discussed there.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we probably need to call it quits, but I encourage anyone that has more questions to stay along and ask. I assume you'll be willing to talk to more people afterwards. So thank you again very much. It was very enlightening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great, it was really, I learned so much.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.